at how he could have ridden that wave to even greater destruction. Civilization, he liked to tell us, is just a thin veneer. We like to think that we, as Americans, are different. But we're just human beings. Nations arise telling a story that binds people together in sacrifice and cooperation, allowing for remarkable feats. But those same stories have so often been used to oppress and dehumanize those who are different. The wars of the modern age teach us this truth. Hiroshima teaches this truth. Technological progress, without an equivalent progress in human institutions, can doom us. The scientific revolution that led to the splitting of an atom requires a moral revolution as well. I thought of Obama's line about storytelling. "That's our job," he'd said. Back home in our campaign, Trump was telling a story that dehumanized others, those who are different. The stakes of that campaign, of any campaign that concludes in giving a human being the power to destroy whole cities, seemed entirely divorced from its conduct. My own nation's story began with simple words. All men are created equal and endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Realizing that ideal has never been easy, even within our own borders, even among our own citizens. But staying true to that story is worth the effort. It is an ideal to be strived for, an ideal that extends across continents and across oceans. The irreducible worth of every person, the insistence that every life is precious, the radical and necessary notion that we are part of a single human family. That is the story that we all must tell. These were words he'd written. For nearly 8 years, Obama had been telling this story. Were people at home listening? I stared down at the concrete in front of me and closed my eyes tightly for a brief moment. Those who died, they are like us. Ordinary people understand this, I think. They do not want more war. They would rather that the wonders of science be focused on improving life and not eliminating it. When the choices made by nations, when the choices made by leaders, reflect this simple wisdom, then the lesson of Hiroshima is done. These were words I'd written. For nearly 8 years, I had seen how ordinary people often seemed to understand Obama better than the people who had the largest platforms to render judgment on him. That was the thing that gave me hope. When he was done, Obama went over and greeted the atomic bomb survivors. An elderly man with discolored skin and an enormous smile wept, and Obama pulled him into a half-embrace, patting his back. It was silent except for the clicks of hundreds of camera shutters being released at once, sounding like the striking of typewriter keys. We got back into the Beast for the drive back to the helicopter. "You should send a link of that speech to Assad and ISIL and Putin," he told me. "And Xi," I said. "No," Obama replied. "The Chinese have not generally been about expansion. They've been focused on consolidating control, and they're fragile." Then he returned to ancient history. "The expansionists," he said, "were not the Chinese, but the Mongols." "Genghis Khan is a reminder of what people can do to each other," he said. "He came from nothing and conquered half the world. His people would get to the edge of a town and give two choices. Surrender, and you'll be killed immediately. Don't surrender, and you'll be boiled alive in oil, your daughters will be raped in front of you." He only had to do that in a few places. "The word got around," I said. It was, again, his way of talking about Hiroshima. "They had an edge," he said. "In their case, it wasn't an atomic bomb. It was good horsemanship. On the helicopter ride, the weight of the moment had lifted a bit, and we talked about random things. The upcoming schedule, the next markers we had to hit with the time remaining. "I'm going to miss Unga this year," Susan said. "I'm going to fly with my son out to Stanford, where he's starting in September."
"That's exactly where you should be," Obama said. "We're going to miss them a lot."
He looked out the window. Malia was about to graduate from high school. As we made our descent to the tarmac next to Air Force One, Obama more directly conveyed how much he'd begun thinking about the end of his time in office.
"I'm not certain of many things," he said, "but I am certain of one. On my deathbed, I won't be thinking about a bill I passed or an election I won or a speech I gave. I'll be thinking about my daughters and moments involving them."
Chapter 31. Information Wars. On July 17, 2014, Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur was shot down over eastern Ukraine, killing all 298 people on board. The plane had been flying over territory controlled by Russian-backed separatists, armed by Russia, where Russian advisors were present. A few days later, the Russian Foreign Ministry held a press conference in Moscow and put forward several different and contradictory theories for how the plane was shot down. A Ukrainian combat aircraft did it. Ukrainian surface-to-air missiles were in the area. The missile that shot down the plane was actually in territory controlled by the Ukrainian government. These theories were repeated by Russia's major state-run news outlets, RT and Sputnik, and flooded social media feeds in Russia and Europe. It didn't matter much that the shifting Russian explanations could be debunked. The investigation was going to take years. With their media capabilities and willingness to lie, the Russians could fill that space with all manner of false narratives. Since the protests had ousted Russia's client leader in Ukraine in 2014, we'd grown accustomed to Russian disinformation. Sometimes it could be thuggishly personal. Jen Psaki, who was then our State Department spokeswoman, was a target. Russian media outlets, amplified by Russian bots, invented quotes from her to discredit our policies. In social media campaigns, her head was superimposed on the body of a model in a provocative pose to suggest that she was a crude, unserious person. Then there were the lies about policy. "There are no Russian advisors in Ukraine. There is no Russian military equipment crossing into Ukraine. Russia had no responsibility for the shootdown of MH17. Those of us who had to fight it out in the information space with the Russians on a daily basis started pressing our government to move faster in debunking Russian narratives and building our capabilities to counter disinformation. A little over a week after MH17, we got the intelligence community to declassify overhead imagery that showed Russian military equipment pouring over the Ukrainian border, but it was still framed by objective international media outlets as a he-said-she-said story, and Russia just issued more denials in response. We were like traditional newspapers trying to keep up with the Internet. Because we had to be fact-based, because we had to be mindful of sensitive intelligence, we were slower than the Russians and couldn't be as definitive in our statements or as far-reaching in our social media presence. I felt this asymmetry acutely. Whoever did my job in Russia was sitting on top of billion-dollar investments in television stations, marshaled an army of internet trolls who populated social media, and was empowered to lie with impunity. I had 5 people working in the NSC press office and my own official Twitter feed. U.S. government broadcasting has a legal firewall against editorial direction from the White House. It took lengthy meetings and email chains to declassify information to debunk Russian narratives. Obama occasionally asked me to think about how we could revamp our international broadcasting to make it more relevant, more responsive, to find ways to compete with the Russian juggernaut. In a 2014 meeting,
We showed him what, hypothetically, it would take to replicate something like RT. Hundreds of millions of dollars, hundreds of people, and greater White House supervision. He laughed. I'm sure the Republicans are going to sign off on giving me a $1 billion propaganda channel. The idea was quickly abandoned. Instead, we worked for more incremental advances. We launched a new Russian-language broadcasting channel and prioritized media markets in Eastern Europe and Russia's periphery. But this was a drop in the ocean compared to the Russian effort. At the same time that we confronted the danger of Russian disinformation in 2014 and 2015, we had a parallel effort to combat ISIL's social media campaign to recruit and radicalize Americans. A team of outside experts from the technology sector recommended changes that led to the creation of a new unit at the State Department, the Global Engagement Center, GEC, which could serve as a hub to coordinate efforts across the U.S. government, mapping and spotlighting ISIL propaganda, lifting up credible voices against ISIL, and producing content that pushed back on ISIL messaging. Recognizing that Russia now posed a bigger challenge, we added the mission of countering Russian disinformation to the GEC and formally stood it up in April 2016. The budget was in the low tens of millions of dollars. To understand what ended up happening in the 2016 presidential election, you have to understand this. When protests toppled the Ukrainian government, Putin interpreted that as the United States coming into Russia, akin to an act of war. When he launched his counterattack, annexing Crimea, creeping into eastern Ukraine, he weaponized information and showed a willingness to lie, using traditional media like television and new media platforms like Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube to spread disinformation into open Western societies like a virus. Eventually, the Russians would come into America as they believed we'd gone into Ukraine. They took advantage of the fact that we were worn down by decades of political polarization and the balkanization of our media. America's antibodies to the sickness of Russian disinformation were weak, if they were there at all. In April 2016, we landed in London for a hastily arranged trip to help David Cameron fight off a Brexit referendum. Cameron's chief of staff, Ed Llewellyn, had emailed me a couple of months earlier urging the visit. They were barely ahead in the polls and fearful, and Obama polled at more than 70% in the United Kingdom. A strong expression of support from him might be enough to inch them over the finish line. On the flight over, I emailed back and forth with Cameron's staff about an op-ed that Obama was publishing in the Daily Telegraph, making the case for Britain to stay in the European Union. It was unusual to coordinate so closely with a foreign government, but the Brits were different, and Brexit would be calamitous, a crucial piece of the post-World War II order drifting off into the sea. After we landed, I showed Obama a dueling op-ed that had been written by Boris Johnson, the bombastic mayor of London and a chief proponent of Brexit. To counter-program our trip and appeal to nationalist sentiment in the UK, the whole lead-in was an indictment of Obama for swapping out a bust of Winston Churchill in the Oval Office. Some said, Johnson wrote, it was a symbol of the part Kenyan president's ancestral dislike of the British Empire, of which Churchill had been such a fervent defender. Really? Obama said. The black guy doesn't like the British? We were standing in the U.S. Ambassador's house in London, a stately mansion with a lawn so big, with grass so carefully cut, that it resembled a football field without lines. They're more subtle back home, I said. Not really, he said. Boris is their Trump. With better hair. Obama chuckled. Talk to Cameron's folks, he said. Get me the best arguments for and against Brexit. I talked to Llewellyn and got a thick briefing packet with the key arguments on both sides. The problem, for those who wanted to stay in the EU, was that many of the arguments for Brexit were built on lies. About how much the UK paid into the European Union. about how Brexit wouldn't hurt the British economy. Another problem was that the Brexit campaign was tapping into the same sense of nationalism and nostalgia that the Trump campaign was promoting back home. The days of Churchill, the absence of immigrants and intrusive international institutions. The arguments for staying in the EU were grounded in facts, not emotion. The EU was Britain's largest market. The EU offered Britain a stronger voice in global affairs. Even the name of the campaign, Remain, sounded like a concession that life wasn't going to be all that you hoped it would be. We had a long, friendly meeting with Cameron at 10 Downing Street. Cameron explained to Obama that one of the claims from the Brexit crowd was that the UK could quickly negotiate a trade deal with the United States if they left. What? There's no way that could happen. Isn't that right, Roman? He called out to our trade advisor. The Brits laughed. We'd be at the back of the queue, one of them said. It'd be great, Cameron said, if you could make that point publicly. At the press conference, Obama and Cameron spoke in front of clusters of flags. My understanding, Obama said, is that some of the folks on the other side have been ascribing to the United States certain actions we'll take if the UK does leave the EU. He repeated the formulation that the UK would be at the back of the queue for a trade agreement. And he went out of his way to talk about his admiration for Churchill. I don't know if people are aware of this, but in the residence on the second floor, my office, my private office, is called the Treaty Room. And right outside the door of the Treaty Room, so that I see it every day, including on weekends, when I'm going into that office to watch a basketball game, the primary image I see is a bust of Winston Churchill. It's there voluntarily because I can do anything on the second floor. I love Winston Churchill. The British press laughed. Then he turned the knife into Johnson. Now, when I was elected as President of the United States, my predecessor had kept a Churchill bust in the Oval Office. There are only so many tables where you can put busts. Otherwise, it starts looking a little cluttered. And I thought it was appropriate, and I suspect most people here in the United Kingdom might agree, that as the first African-American president, it might be appropriate to have a bust of Dr. Martin Luther King in my office to remind me of all the hard work of a lot of people who would somehow allow me to have the privilege of holding this office. I looked over at Cameron's people on the other side of the room, and they were congratulating one another. That night, I went out to dinner with Cameron's team to celebrate a visit that had accomplished everything they had asked. But Llewellyn, a man who usually had a wide, genuine smile affixed to his face, looked uneasy. "It's going to be close, I'm afraid," he said. "We just need people to break in the end for the safer choice." The wine flowed. We laughed at 7 years of stories, Cameron and Obama playing ping pong and losing to some kids, Cameron flying out to Dayton, Ohio to watch a basketball game with Obama in 2012 and having no idea what the rules of the game were. In a world that led to different outcomes, the dinner would have been a memorable valedictory, a group of people satisfied that they had done their best with the time they had occupying places of leadership in the free world. But this was an uncertain moment. "How are you feeling about Trump?" Llewellyn asked toward the end of dinner. "He's probably the Republican that Hillary has the best chance to beat," I said. "You're not worried that he can win?" "Putin would like nothing more. Some of our people," he said, referring to conservatives who support Brexit, "say that he's tapped into something with this immigration issue. From Central America." "Unaccompanied children," I said. "Yes, that's right. The same way people are feeling about immigration here, a loss of control." "That's true," I said. "When I watch his rallies, I think how potent his message would be from a more skilled politician." I took a sip of red wine, enjoying the easy chatter of voices from a Saturday night crowd at a comfortable London restaurant. "But, you know," I said, "like you, we need people to break for the safer choice." Back home, Nancy Obama had to wait until the end of a bitter Democratic primary before he could get out and start campaigning. like a basketball player waiting by the scorer's table to check into a game. Bernie Sanders had come to meet him after Clinton clinched the race, and I got some inkling of the challenge she had faced. The steps of the EEOB were filled with young Obama White House staffers, craning their necks, trying to get a glimpse of their populist hero. Our first rally with Clinton was in Charlotte, and the crowd was familiar. Obama people, thousands of them, a sea of white, black, and brown faces, waiting to erupt into applause when he walked on stage. Just a few hours earlier, the director of the FBI, James Comey, had given a press conference in which he announced that he wouldn't pursue charges against Clinton, but harshly criticized her use of a private email server. We'd gotten no heads up that this announcement was coming. We were in a staff meeting in McDonough's office when Comey came on television, and we watched in silence, nervous as he assailed her, then relieved when he said there'd be no charges. McDonough steered us back to the business at hand. On the flight down to Charlotte, I had joined a lengthy conversation with Obama, Clinton, and Jake Sullivan about Syria policy. She sat and listened closely as Obama described the latest effort to negotiate some kind of ceasefire with the Russians, an effort that was likely to fail. I could see her turning the issue over in her head, absorbing the complexity of the different forces fighting on the ground with the support of different foreign powers. The Middle East was going to be a difficult inheritance, but, as Obama liked to remind me, he'd be leaving his successor a healthy economy, an ISIL campaign on the road to success, and no American war in Syria. While Obama launched into a ringing endorsement of Clinton in Charlotte, I was pacing backstage on a conference call with Jake and John Podesta about how the Democratic Party would handle the issue of trade generally and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, specifically, in the party platform. Clinton had tacked left because of Bernie in the primaries, disavowing an agreement she had helped to negotiate. But Obama wanted to get it through Congress. We agreed on a formula that welcomed differences of view in the party. When the rally was over, our motorcade stopped off at a nearby barbecue joint. It was the kind of thing that Obama did at nearly every campaign stop in 2012. You do a rally, then you go to some local restaurant, order a bunch of food, and shake everyone's hand. I sat in a black SUV outside the restaurant while Obama and Clinton went inside. A few minutes later, I saw Clinton come out and get into a car, and I figured we were leaving. Another 30 minutes or so went by before Obama came out. After we boarded the plane, he walked down the long hallway of Air Force One to where a few of us were clustered. "Did you guys see Hillary leave?" he asked. "Yeah," I said. "She came out after a few minutes." His jacket was off and his sleeves rolled up. He had his campaign swagger, a looseness in his body language, like an athlete who'd just finished a game. "We went in, ordered some food, took pictures with the staff, and then she left," he said. "I ended up shaking every hand in there. Most of the folks in these places have been watching Fox News and think I'm the Antichrist. But if you show up, shake their hand, and look them in the eye, it's harder for them to turn you into a caricature. You might even pick up a few votes." We all stood there, not knowing what to say. Unspoken was the fact that everything was riding on this campaign, and yet he wasn't the one running. Clinton had a lead, and she would have to make it stick. "Well," he said, "go get some barbecue." A pile of takeout bags awaited in the conference room. A few weeks later, I flew up to Philadelphia with Obama for the Democratic Convention. In 2008, I'd sat in the middle of a stadium of 100,000 people watching Obama speak. This time, I was standing on the stage as he spoke, running through the accomplishments of the last 8 years, offering an endorsement of Clinton, and turning Trump's slogan around. "America is already great. America is already strong. And I promise you, our strength, our greatness, does not depend on Donald Trump." I felt a tug of nostalgia. Obama was receding as a figure, Soon he and I would exit the stage. At the end, Clinton walked out and the two of them stood there, arms around each other, an African-American and a woman, waving to a roaring, diverse crowd. It was the opposite tableau from Trump's angry and almost entirely white convention. It felt like a different country. When they were done, I found myself in the small group of people backstage with them. After a few minutes of small talk, Obama left to go tape some ads, so I was left alone with Clinton in an empty hold room. Jake had asked me to give her some last-minute advice on her acceptance speech. "Remember," I said, "that you'll already have the audience in the room. They're going to love whatever you say. That's not who you're talking to. You're talking to the people at home." She nodded, a smile on her face. The conversation quickly turned to a recent trip I'd taken to Burma. She came alive, peppering me with questions. "How is Da Su?" she asked, using Aung San Suu Kyi's honorific name. I gave a lengthy explanation of how she was adjusting to being a politician, balancing her quiet power struggle with the military, an ethnic reconciliation process, and a combustible situation in Rakhine State. "She has to worry about the Chinese in all this, doesn't she?" Clinton asked. "Yes," I said, "especially with the Hua and Kokang, naming two obscure ethnic groups along the Chinese border." She nodded intently. This was her greatest strength and her greatest challenge. Here we were, 15 minutes after perhaps the high point of her political career, and she wanted to discuss the intricacies of Burma policy. She was kind, curious, and ready to be president, but she had less instinct for the mechanics of how to get there. As the room slowly filled with people, I saw Obama and Bill Clinton off to the side, in an animated conversation about some recent political news. I felt a little awkward, monopolizing the most important person in the room. Obama shot me a few quizzical looks. Finally, he came over and broke up the conversation. "What are you guys talking about?" he asked. "Burma," I said, and he looked at me as if I was crazy. He'd come to care a lot about Burma over the years, joining me in trying to prod that distant country in the right direction. A year later, when the Burmese military escalated a campaign to cleanse Rakhine State of the Rohingya, Hillary's attention to the details of this distant land could have made a difference. But in this political moment, it didn't. "Ben, no one in Ohio cares about Burma." It hardly came as a surprise that the Russians hacked into the DNC. From my first day at work, I'd been told to assume that any unclassified email I sent, any non-secure phone call I made, could be intercepted by the Russians. They'd already hacked into U.S. government servers. But just before the Democratic Convention, WikiLeaks dumped thousands of DNC emails into the public domain in an effort to sow discord within the Democratic Party. This was new, something of far greater scale and consequence than releasing intercepted phone calls in Ukraine. Debbie Wasserman Schultz had resigned as chair in the face of outrage from Bernie Sanders supporters who saw in the emails that she'd shown favoritism for the Clinton campaign. The leaks continued throughout the summer, a steady release of the kind of gossipy emails designed to draw attention from the political press, popping up on platforms with names such as DC Leaks and Guccifer 2.0. It was all painfully familiar, the same brand of disruption that the Russians pursued in Ukraine and across Europe. The Clinton campaign was already fingering the Russians, but when the White House and NSC press shops would ask what we could say about it publicly, we'd be given little running room by the intelligence community. It took us weeks to be authorized to say even that the FBI was investigating the DNC hack. On the subject of Russian complicity, we could only cite past statements by U.S. officials expressing concern about Russian hacking. That summer, I noticed that Situation Room meetings were being held that weren't marked on the calendar. It was the same pattern that prefaced the Bin Laden raid, cabinet-level officials showing up for meetings that weren't on the books. I knew enough not to ask questions. I hoped it was a sign of some special operation. Maybe we were going to nab Zarqawi, the leader of Al-Qaeda, or Baghdadi, the leader of ISIL. Whatever it was, there was a premium being put on secrecy, and the group meeting was very small. At the beginning of September, we flew to China for the G20 summit, where Obama would have his final meeting with Putin before the election. They met in a large conference room. I sat on one side of the table with Obama, Susan Rice, and John Kerry. Putin sat on the other side, flanked by three stoic, fleshy men. There was always a charge when you were in the room with Obama and Putin, a sense that you were witnessing an exchange that the whole world would want to see. But whatever privileged access I might have felt was undercut by the difference in our positions. Obama would be gone in a few months, and I would disappear along with him. Putin wasn't going anywhere. The two of them debated the same topics that had driven us further apart over the past 3 years. On Ukraine, they had the same tense, legalistic debate that had characterized their every exchange since 2014. Implementation of a peace plan had stalled, and Putin blamed Ukraine's president, Petro Poroshenko. "When Poroshenko opens his mouth," Putin said, "he lies." On Syria, they discussed a ceasefire plan in which Russia would stop the bombardment of opposition areas and allow humanitarian access. In exchange, we'd separate out the opposition we supported from the Al-Qaeda affiliate Al-Nusra. Putin expressed support but mocked the possibility of separating Al-Nusra from the opposition. "By trying to provide support to moderates without backing Al-Nusra," he said smugly, "we were trying to climb a spruce tree naked without scratching our ass." Obama never lost his patience with Putin. As the meeting dragged on, I stared at him, a short man with thin hair combed across his head, who always had the same half-smirk and level gaze frozen on his face, whether he was telling a joke or getting angry. So many of the things that clouded our second term, Assad's brutal war, the permanent crisis in Ukraine, Edward Snowden living in a Moscow apartment, relentless hacking, were tied directly to the decisions of this one man. Rather than erupt in frustration, Obama piled up the logic. "You should end the Syrian civil war," he told Putin, "or else the jihadists are going to come after you, and you're going to bleed more money and men in Syria. You should end the crisis in Ukraine and get out from under sanctions, because the next president is not going to be in a position to lift them." In response, Putin did what he'd done for years. He expressed an interest in cooperation, while his body language suggested no such interest. He'd priced out the consequences of his actions, and he didn't care. After about an hour, I was asked to leave the room, and Obama stayed behind with Susan Rice. Later, we all came together before Obama's press conference and went through the questions he was likely to get asked. Josh Earnest and I raised the issue of Russian hacking. Obama waved his styrofoam teacup at us. "I know how I'm going to handle that," he said. He and Susan looked at each other, and I realized this must have been one of the subjects that was covered when I was out of the room. When he was asked about it in the press conference, Obama said, "I'm not going to comment on specific investigations that are still live and active, but I will tell you that we've had problems with cyber intrusions from Russia in the past, from other countries in the past. And look, we're moving into a new era here where a number of countries have significant capacities. And frankly, we've got more capacity than anybody, both offensively and defensively." The reference to offensive cyber capacity, I could tell, was a thinly veiled threat. Shortly after we got back to Washington, I filed into the Oval Office for the regular morning briefing. Toward the end of his briefing, Jim Clapper said something about plans for a statement on Russia, and Obama encouraged him to move faster on it. Susan made eye contact with me, eyebrows arched, glasses down on her nose. After years, we'd learned to communicate with looks. This one meant that she wanted to talk with me after. I followed her down the hall to her office, and she asked me to close the door. I sat down at the wooden table I'd sat at hundreds, if not thousands, of times over the last 8 years. "Look, we've had a small group of principals meeting on Russia," she said, referring to the kind of high-level working group that focuses on a particularly sensitive issue. "Dennis didn't want you to be involved because you are the one authorized to talk with Jake. For your own protection. And ours." I stared hard at the books on her shelves. She went on to explain that we were trying to get Congress to put out a bipartisan statement on Russian meddling in the election, and then the intelligence community would put out its own. "Do you want me to draft it?" I asked. "No," she said. "This is going to be an IC process, but we'll need you to think through the questions we'll get asked after." I walked downstairs to my office and sank into my chair. For 8 years, I'd worked my way up to the place where I thought I'd always be in the room, and now I was being kept out of the most important conversation of all. My mind raced with a mix of self-pity and self-blame. Sure, the explanation Susan gave made sense, but my contacts with Jake Sullivan had all been authorized and limited to a few calls about TPP. I couldn't help thinking that it was something else. Benghazi, maybe, or the New York Times Magazine debacle. Damaged goods, an easy Republican target. Someone who my closest colleagues had determined needed to be kept out of meetings about the thing we could all see playing out with our own eyes. I went to each of our lead communications people to get help preparing the questions that we anticipated would come up after the intelligence community put out their statement. Jen Psaki, herself a target of Russian meddling. Josh Earnest, who'd gamely fielded questions on the issue for weeks. Ned Price, my deputy. The Q&A we prepared anticipated the questions we were going to get, and also reflected our own frustration at being on the outside of the process. "Why didn't you tell us earlier? Is Russia trying to help Trump win? What are you going to do in response?" The statement got held up for a couple of weeks for two reasons. First, an effort to secure a strong bipartisan statement against Russian meddling from the congressional leadership met resistance from the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, who pointedly refused to sign on. Democrats like Dianne Feinstein and Adam Schiff, the ranking members on the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, were alarmed and incensed, and they put out their own statement on September 22nd. "Based on briefings we have received, we have concluded that the Russian intelligence agencies are making a serious and concerted effort to influence the U.S. election. We hope all Americans will stand together and reject the Russian effort." McConnell's refusal was staggeringly partisan and unpatriotic in its disregard for a foreign adversary undermining our democracy. But the sad truth is that it wasn't surprising in the context of the Republican Party of 2016, which had spent 8 years disbanding norms and had circled the wagons behind a demagogue. Obama reflected this sense of exhaustion. "What else did you expect from McConnell?" he said. "He won't even give us a hearing on Merrick Garland." He was, after 8 years, worn down by Republican obstructionism. Second, there was a debate about who would sign the intelligence community statement. Not all of the leaders of the intelligence community wanted to be named, particularly Comey, which struck us as ironic, considering how talkative he'd been about the Clinton email investigation. Ultimately, Clapper stepped up and agreed to put it in his name as the leader of the intelligence community. Jay Johnson, the Secretary of Homeland Security, would attach his name as well, since he was responsible for defending the architecture of the U.S. election from cyber attack. On October 7th, the statement was finally ready for release. It was the most consequential public statement made on national security in my 8 years of government that I had no role in preparing. Referring to the release of hacked documents, the statement said that the thefts and disclosures are intended to interfere with the U.S. election process, Only Russia's senior-most officials could have authorized these activities. It was a Friday. Josh, Jen, and I asked Dennis and Susan if anyone would be doing Sunday shows. The answer was no. The statement would speak for itself. After Benghazi, there were rarely any volunteers to go on the shows. As with McConnell's obstructionism, Republican attacks had worn people down and, perhaps, intimidated them. The statement went out from the DNI. Ned was prepared to respond to incoming inquiries, working from talking points that hewed closely to the text of the statement. When asked about our response, we'd just say we had a variety of ways to impose consequences on Russia. Feeling like a supporting actor in this drama, I left at a reasonable hour that evening. As the gate of the White House clanged closed behind me, I looked down at my BlackBerry and saw a breaking news clip that there was a new Access Hollywood tape of Trump boasting about sexually assaulting women. Our statement wouldn't be the biggest news story of the day, after all. One afternoon that fall, I went to the Brookings Institution to meet with a group that could qualify as the heart of the American foreign policy establishment. It was a regular session hosted by Robert Kagan, a prominent neoconservative. Around the table were columnists like Tom Friedman and David Ignatius, along with a host of experts. When we all sat down, they gave me a gift, a movie poster for The Blob, embracing the derisive moniker that I'd used in the New York Times Magazine. I chuckled gamely and rolled it up, settling in for a bruising hour. One after the other, they launched into criticisms of Obama's foreign policy, laying the blame for Ukraine, the catastrophe in Syria, Brexit, and the rise of China at his feet. This reached a crescendo when Leon Wieseltier, an editor at the New Republic and self-appointed moralist, launched into a diatribe in which he declared that Obama was the first American president in history to betray American values. I sat there seething. Wieseltier had been a member of the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq, and did as much as anyone to offer an impression that the liberal intelligentsia supported the war in Iraq, a moral catastrophe that had betrayed American values. Iraq, a place where our bombs, not someone else's, had killed children. I answered patiently. "I'd just come back from Laos," I said, "where unexploded American bombs were still killing kids over 40 years after they'd been dropped." Then I repeated my lengthy refrain about why not going to war in Syria wasn't a betrayal of who we are, that there were no good options, that we were trying to preserve America's capacity to lead the world rather than fighting an endless series of wars in the Middle East. Underneath, I felt incredulous. "You guys are aiming your fire at Obama when we are a few weeks away from an election in which someone who is a clear and present danger to American values and international order could win." When the session was over, I walked out into a sunny and unseasonably hot afternoon, my shirt sticking to my back. Friedman followed me out and expressed regret at the tone in the room. "I think we just got to a place where we were talking past each other," he said of the last couple of years. I had come to like and respect him over the years and said thank you. Then I walked back to the White House, dropping my blob poster into a trash can along the way. Obama's popularity kept rising in the country and around the world, but the criticism being leveled at our foreign policy at home had reached a fever pitch that reinforced Trump's dystopian vision of an America in freefall. Of course, the world was faced with a challenging moment. Everything we had tried had failed to stop the killing in Syria. Refugees were pouring into Europe. Russia was lashing out, from Ukraine to Syria. But Obama was the most respected leader in the world, and the acknowledgement that there might also be limits to our capacity to solve all of the world's problems could be easily cast aside by someone like Trump, who simply asserted that he alone could do so. We were at the center of power, ensconced in the White House. But we had less and less control over the political forces roiling the country, the toxic brand of nationalism on display at Trump rallies, a media that was increasingly broken into hermetically sealed, impenetrable partisan echo chambers, the obvious Russian efforts to influence our election that continued unabated. Even our scandals had moved on. Benghazi was no longer about Susan Rice's Sunday show appearances. It was now about Hillary Clinton's private email server, something to justify chance of lock her up. In a way, I welcomed the chance to retreat into the backdrop of this drama. I walked my daughter to daycare on my shoulders, counting the passing buses. I listened to all 179 episodes of a podcast about the history of Rome, lying in bed contemplating the dreams of emperors long dead. I binge-watched The Americans with Anne, sitting on the couch in a darkened room, following American actors playing Russians pretending to be Americans. I began my days eating the foil-wrapped egg and sausage burritos that warmed under a heat lamp in the White House mess. I plodded through my bucket list, which had increasingly intersected with the ghosts of American interventions past. $90 million to clean up bombs in Laos, negotiating agreements with Cuba, implementing the Iran deal. I chaired meetings on our nascent effort to combat Russian disinformation in Europe. In an October meeting with Obama, the Italian Prime Minister, Matteo Renzi, raised the issue of Russian meddling. "They are," he said, "doing the same thing in Italy as they are doing to you here. The Italians had a referendum coming up in December. If it failed, Renzi would have to stand down as Prime Minister, opening the door to Putin's friend, Silvio Berlusconi." Renzi described how the Russians were creating fake news stories and then steering them to specific regions. It was sophisticated, not just anti-referendum, but mini-scandals that created clouds around members of Renzi's coalition. "Ben's been working on this problem," Obama said. "Your people should follow up with him." Renzi looked at me expectantly, as if I had the answers. By that point, WikiLeaks was publishing John Podesta's emails, a drip, drip, drip of gossip that created an aura of scandal and mirrored the themes Trump was sounding on the campaign trail. Hillary was at the center of a corrupt establishment. Hillary took money from Wall Street. Hillary was in poor health. The Clinton Foundation was a criminal enterprise. The leaked documents, the Trump rallies, and a flood of stories, some true, some false, some a blend of fact and fiction, worked in unison like a symphony. Our government had responded to the Russian meddling as a cybersecurity issue. The people who'd been in meetings were largely intelligence and cyber experts. Not one person had a communications background, despite the fact that we'd been dealing with fake news in Ukraine for more than 2 years. That October 7th statement said nothing about fake news or disinformation. Cybersecurity was something that the government could at least get its mind around. Secure systems, issue warnings, stopping a flood of propaganda from overwhelming people's Facebook feeds and Google searches was not something that the government could do, or something that the tech companies wanted to do. Even if we were more focused on the fake news, Obama couldn't become editor-in-chief of people's social media feeds. If I scanned the internet or Twitter, slogging through the cascade of attacks on Hillary, it was impossible to know where the stories came from. Breitbart? InfoWars? An American? Or a Russian? The content was the same. I'd raise this with Obama. "I know," he'd say. "They've found the soft spot in our democracy." In prep sessions for press appearances, we'd raise the criticisms that Obama should speak out more on the issue of Russian meddling. "I talk about it every time I'm asked," he'd say. "What else are we going to do? We've warned folks." Of course, we had no idea. Obama had no idea, at the time, that there was an FBI investigation into the Trump campaign's contacts with Russia. That information was walled off from the White House, and I wouldn't even learn about it until long after I left government, in the press. Clinton was further ahead than we had been at the same point in 2012, and it looked as if she was going to win. On the campaign trail, Trump was railing that the election was rigged and that the Russia allegations were fake news. The crowds responded with a bloodlust that would have been comical if it wasn't so frightening. "If I speak out more," Obama said, "he'll just say it's rigged." A few days before the election, Susan convened a meeting in her office. "Dennis wants us to prepare for the possibility that Clinton wins and Trump says the whole thing was rigged." "What does that have to do with us?" I asked. "He's worried about the Russia angle. He wants us to think about validators." For the next 30 minutes, we brainstormed a list of Republicans who could come out immediately after the election to help counter the inevitable accusation from a losing Trump that we'd made up the Russia story. People like Condi Rice, Brent Scowcroft, Jim Baker. We had meetings to plan for the likelihood of a Clinton victory and what we'd do with Obama's remaining time in office. The confirmation of Merrick Garland securing a liberal majority on the Supreme Court for a generation. We could line up some concessions from TPP countries, secure Hillary's tacit approval, get the deal through Congress, the final piece of our foreign policy legacy. Perhaps something bold could be done on Middle East peace. At home, we could push for criminal justice reform. Maybe Obama could decriminalize marijuana. We also assessed the alternative of a Trump victory. We had a gloomy meeting in McDonough's office where we digested the scenario. "Can you imagine how the Russians would respond?" I said. The room was silent. In the last week before the election, I went on a couple of campaign trips with Obama. He was loose, powerful on the stump, deconstructing Trump, puffing up Clinton. But it felt a bit like a classic rock concert. The crowds roared, the music played. They were there to see Obama, to hear the hits, but they seemed less enthused when he spoke about Clinton, who was counting on Obama's coalition, young people, blacks, Hispanics, to turn out for her in similar numbers. One afternoon, I was sitting on the Marine One flight back to the White House after a campaign swing to Florida. It was just a few days before the election. We got an email from Obama's political director with the last requests for Obama's time from the Clinton campaign. The day before the election, could he go to Michigan and Pennsylvania? "Michigan?" Obama said, eyes wide. It was a state he'd won by 10 points in 2012. "That's not good." Chapter 32. The End. Election night, I picked up some Chinese food and headed over to Cody Keenan's house. It was going to be an early night, we thought, given Clinton's lead in the polls. As I walked into his building, I checked my phone to find that Florida appeared to be going for Trump. We sat there for the next few hours as the map showed slowly spreading red. Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. States we hadn't worried about in 2012. That was it. I drank warming beer and occasionally walked into the kitchen to eat lo mein, standing at the counter. For long stretches of time, we said nothing to each other, together in a room, alone with our thoughts. So many things I had worked on, from Iran to Cuba to climate change, were now at risk. It was all happening too fast to digest. It seemed as if it couldn't be real, that the country and world could turn that abruptly from the story of the last 8 years to the brand of racist, mean-spirited, truthless politics that had shadowed us since 2008. Everything was suddenly eclipsed. I felt enveloped in a darkness. After Trump was declared the victor, Obama emailed Cody to call him through the switchboard so that we could discuss what he was going to say about this the next day. We called him on a BlackBerry, putting the phone on speaker. Both of us had received dozens of calls like this, but the familiarity only made it feel more cruel. "So, that happened," he said. He He sounded surprised, but as if he was trying to force himself to be subdued, like a man who just received an unexpected diagnosis and is trying to avoid getting too upset. "What do you want to say?" Cody asked, laptop out, yet another speech to write. Obama plowed through a set of boilerplate messages that suddenly seemed radical in contrast to Trump. Pay tribute to democracy. Congratulate Trump and say nice things about Hillary. Pledge an orderly and professional transition. There should be something at the end for young people, he said. Don't get discouraged. Don't get cynical. I had been largely silent. Do you want to offer any reassurance to the rest of the world? What do you have in mind? He asked. Something for our allies, for NATO? That the United States will continue to be there for them? There was a pause on the other end of the line. No, he said. I don't think that I'm the one to tell them that. I walked home in the early morning darkness, 7 blocks, moving slowly as if delaying getting home and going to bed would forestall the world that was to come. The trees were half empty of leaves, and the half-light of the street lamps cast a ghostly light. Obama sent me a brief note reminding me that there are more stars in the sky than grains of sand on the earth. I sent him one back that progress doesn't move in a straight line. I walked past the apartment on S Street where I'd lived when I was 27 years old. I remembered how I'd planned to move back to New York City. I'd met Anne and stuck it out in my job. We'd moved in together. Then I got this job working for Obama. When I got home, Anne and I talked a bit. I'm sorry. I don't know what to say, she said. After all the work you guys did. She let her thought trail off. She was 7 months pregnant with our second child, who would be born in an America that I couldn't yet reconcile. I know, I said, sitting on the edge of the bed. I know. I slept for 3 or 4 hours. When I woke, I had a sensation that I'd known only a few times in my life, the feeling that you don't want the knowledge you'd gone to sleep with to be true. When someone has died. When something like 9/11 has happened. It was a sense of profound anxiety, a shortness of breath, a constriction in the chest. It was all of those things at once. An event that would challenge my assumptions about America and alter the course of the world as well as my own life. After all the work we'd done, it was going to end like this. I couldn't shake the feeling that I should have seen it coming. Because when you distilled it, stripped out the racism and misogyny, we'd run against Hillary 8 years ago with the same message Trump had used. She's part of a corrupt establishment that can't be trusted to bring change. Change we can believe in. How many times had I written those words? Because Trump was a product of the same forces I'd seen aligning against us for 10 years. Because Sarah Palin, the Tea Party, Benghazi, the irrelevance of facts, a healthy majority of Republicans still did not believe that Obama was born in the United States. The Republicans had ridden this tiger, and we'd all ended up inside. The morning after the election, I went to work, like any other day. I got my PDB, learned about the progress of our counter-ISIL campaign. I ate an egg and sausage burrito. I fought off the sadness that would have been too overwhelming if I succumbed to it. There was still work to do. When I went upstairs for Obama's morning briefing, the entire communications staff of the White House was gathered in the Oval Office. Obama wanted to speak with us directly. He stood in front of the Resolute desk and addressed a large semicircle of people, most of whom were younger than I was. I stood, clutching my iPad with the government's most prized intelligence on it, mine for a couple more months. When I looked at the faces of the assembled group, most were crying. Obama was smiling and tried to strike an optimistic note. The sun is shining, he joked. Then he thanked us all for our work. We are leaving this country indisputably better off than we found it 8 years ago, and that's because of you. He urged us to be professional in the transition, just as George W.